Welcome to the seventh or eighth month of this pandemic economic crisis. We hope you and everyone you care about is safe and healthy and finding a way to stay positive and connected. This crisis, plus the renewed awakening to racial injustice, is having a profound effect on every aspect of our lives, most especially how, where, when, and for whom we work, and what kind of work we do and with whom. That calls for a different kind of leadership at all levels, from the frontline manager to the senior level to the C-suite and the boardroom. I wrote in Forbes recently about how one of the surprising leadership lessons from these crises is that the model of leadership that has been most successful, whether used by men or women, by the way, is the one traditionally associated with women: collaborative, transparent, communicative, and flexible, to name a few characteristics. So what kind of impact exactly will this multi-crisis moment have long-term, and what can we do to leverage it for the greatest good, including for more diverse leadership and more effective and successful organizations for society? Today, we have one of the foremost leaders on these issues to talk about it. So grab your notebook and pen or tablet or laptop and listen up. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts, on our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you are struggling with your own career, especially in this crisis, please reach out to us and let us know via Twitter, LinkedIn, or our Contact Us page on our website. We can help you no matter what industry you're in. It's a stressful time, so be kind to yourself and take care. Only 20% of corporate boards of directors of the top 3,000 publicly traded companies are women, still, according to bizwomen.com. And it's growing at the glacial pace of about 1% a year, and it's far worse for women of color. This, folks, does not make good business sense or good financial sense, which, after all, is the purpose of the board, right? Because multiple studies prove that companies with more women in senior leadership and on their board perform better across a host of metrics, including financial performance. Especially relevant to today's crises, a recent study showed that two or more women on medical product boards means that defective products are pulled off the market much, much faster, if at all. It's really scary. You can listen to my interview with Dr. Corrine Post to hear more about that. So our economy and the entire global economy is in the midst of this massive global paradigm shift. Women seem to be leading the way, so how do we leverage this moment exponentially? I'd like you to meet Coco Brown, founder and CEO of the Athena Alliance, a consulting firm that focuses on executive and board development with a focus on increasing diversity in leadership. She has placed over 100 women on corporate boards. We will let her tell us more about it. Coco sits on for-profit boards herself and has held leadership roles, including CEO, COO, president, board member, et cetera, et cetera. And she, as I said, sits on corporate boards now. Coco was ranked one of the top 100 women of influence in Silicon Valley, too. Very cool. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Coco, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So your site says you coach extraordinary female leaders. What makes a female leader extraordinary?
I love it. So first of all, our focus is on women who are already accomplished, right? So they're already typically at the VP ranks and above. In and of itself, that's sort of extraordinary in today's world. It took us a lot to get there, considering that we're 5% of CEOs and 9% of venture investors and 7% of private company board seats. I mean, we're not even in double digits in most realms at the top. And so you are extraordinary if you are in the top ranks of leadership. And so I think that's enough of a qualification right there.
Thank you. You just made me feel more extraordinary. That's very exciting.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's one of those things, actually, if you think about the bell curve, right? I mean, we're so underrepresented that we don't have a normal bell curve yet for women. Every woman at the top is extraordinary because we had to be in order to get there because so many odds are against us. So you don't see average or underperforming in terms of women at the top.
That's interesting. We still have to do it backwards and at high heels, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the qualities, though, or what are the characteristics that make a woman an extraordinary leader?
Well, I think anybody who's an extraordinary leader in today's world has a very strong balance of leadership capabilities that are very different than they were in centuries past. You know, you mentioned attributes that are found in women being of high value now. I like to think of them as male and female archetypes. If you think about the way we attribute certain attributes to being masculine and certain attributes to being feminine, and these have been for centuries, you know, that assertion and winning and competition and aggressive and, you know, us versus them, those are attributed to the male archetype, whereas nurture and collaboration and communication and community and vulnerability, these are attributed as female attributes. And I think to be an extraordinary leader in general, you have to have a nice balance of both the male and the female attributes. And you can't be overly one or the other. So I think extraordinary women have figured out how to bring their feminine to a male world and to be able to be themselves, to be feminine and still succeed in a world that has valued mostly the masculine.
That's great. I love that. The trick is, a lot of times when you do that, especially in corporate America, you're still labeled as two something, right? I call it the not enough, not enough, not enough, too much syndrome. Where, you know, you're not enough this for that, and you're not that enough this for something else, but then all of a sudden you're too much for everything because you're too big, you're too aggressive, you're too loud, you have too strong a presence, or you're too, you know, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. And until then, you're too meek, you're not.
Right. Although I don't think I've ever been accused of being meek, but there you have it.
Well, yeah, extraordinary women usually haven't been accused of that. But yeah, I think that's part of what makes us extraordinary women is we've had to hold on to the characteristics that are uniquely our own and that may actually be really feminine and difficult to push forward in a world that sees those things as weakness, and change the world to see them as strength. But I think the world is starting to really embrace the feminine and see it as strength, the top, largely because we are increasingly an integrated social society that has to be able to deal with differences and deal with large volumes and communities of voices that need to be nurtured and heard. And we need more feminine qualities in working with a more diverse world.
Well, and I would think that this moment in history is making that even more so, more important. I mean, that's what I said in this piece I wrote. If you just map out, male or female, the qualities of the leaders that have been most successful in this particular crisis right now, they're really the qualities that, I mean, to your point, they're very balanced, but they're for the most part more feminine than the traditional masculine. I mean, you know, like Governor Cuomo of New York, for example, has been, you know, forthright and assertive and you know, focused on winning, if you will, beating the virus, et cetera. And he's been aggressive in his strategies, but he's done it with a collaborative, communicative, transparent style of bringing people along. And he keeps saying, look, and I'm a native New York City girl, so full bias revealed. But, you know, he turns around and goes, look, I can't make 19 million New Yorkers do anything. All I can do is give you information and you can choose. And that's a kind of feminine form of leadership, because that's really what leadership is. It's ultimately influence management.
Exactly. And it used to be that all you had to influence was a small subset of the listeners. And now everybody, it's so easy to listen. It's so easy to be connected. It's so easy to influence that you really do have to touch the entire populace in order to get it to move. And that does take a different set of skills in terms of listening skills and vulnerability and being able to sort of draw in different communities and have them work together. And yeah, it's a very different world now than it ever was, simply because we are so connected.
What questions, I mean, you advance women into leadership and help women become better leaders and get on board. So what are the questions that a woman should ask herself or could ask herself to ascertain if she's ready for the next level of senior leadership? Let's say she's a director wanting to be a VP or a VP wanting to be an SVP or whatever the next level is. What are some of the, or senior VP wanting to be in C-level, what are some of the questions that you would ask them or you would suggest they ask themselves?
The first thing I would say in terms of women reaching into this realm of overarching stewardship of business is that as you director to VP, VP to senior VP, et cetera, as you start to step into the executive realms of the company, you have to start to translate your incredible career that came up through a ladder and a discipline into you as an overarching steward of business, and realize that as you do that, a whole portfolio of opportunity actually starts to open up. And I think this is something that is kind of news to women. And I don't know if it's something that men sort of understand through osmosis and we just don't. But if you think about the way the world has worked, again, for centuries, is that men would retire to talk about business and politics, and women would retire to talk about the society and family and social issues. And so we're not as accustomed to this idea that deal-making happens in this realm of the executive. And deal-making is something that we have to, you know, we really have to sort of build into our DNA. So when you're running a piece of an organization, it's really about, you know, mostly sort of a downward look and an upward look. But when you're an executive in an organization, there's this outward look. There's the world outside the company that you have to communicate with and have relationship to. There's your board that is looking at you, whether you realize it or not. You may actually be engaging with your own board. There's the C-suite that has an eye on you. And then there's all these opportunities that could present themselves to you if you knew that they existed. For example, as you start to get into that executive realm, you may actually really be building some wealth for yourself. And so maybe you want to dabble in investments and be a limited partner in a venture fund. Maybe you want to try your hand at being a CEO somewhere. Maybe you want to be on a private board. Maybe you want to be on a public board. That's what I mean by portfolio. I've noticed that men, as they get into the executive ranks, they naturally understand they should have relationships with venture capital and be advisors to their portfolios, and they should seek outside board seats, and they should navigate the political ecosystem of the company to get into the C-suite. And we women are heads down, just achieving and getting to that next rung on the ladder. And it's time to pop our heads up and look around the executive realm and really think broadly about how big our impact can be.
Well, that's a great way to put it. I love that image of it. The challenge is women are still judged twice as harshly. I mean, men are promoted on potential, women are promoted on performance. And so, as you pointed out earlier, we still have to do it backwards and in high heels, right? So, and number one, and number two, women are historically trained that promoting yourself is not acceptable feminine behavior, right? I mean, I'm a New Yorker, so I'm not sure I got that gene. Thank you. I also come from a father who was an ad man, so there you have it. But most women are kind of conditioned not to be confident and not to put themselves forward, that it's unladylike, right, in some twisted world, or old world, I should say. So there's that historic baggage that we have to get over, whether it's inside of us or inside of the people that we want to talk to about these other opportunities outside of our immediate space.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I missed that gene as well. I've always been an extremely assertive person, and yet I'm also, you know, pretty vulnerable. And I think it is important to kind of create balance between the two. And what I would say to women is, like, you know, for example, back when I was 27 years old, I was promoted to vice president of my company. And I ended up running 2/3 of the business just because of the nature of the business. I was running professional services, and it was a professional services company. And I had never been a director before. And I was just promoted, boom, right from manager to that role. And the way it happened was the guy that they had hired for this role flamed out in a couple of weeks. And so the CEO said, hey, will you take his place and come to our executive retreat and present to us on this whole area of the business that was newly being formed? So I ran around and talked to all my peers and gathered the story, and I went and presented. And then the CEO said, hey, would you like to run this part of the business now? You did a great job. And I thought, great. And he said, go think about how that will happen. And so I came back with an org chart, and I thought through how I wanted everything. And there I was, Coco Brown, vice president, professional services. And he sort of took a gulp, right? Because he didn't actually say he wanted me to be vice president. He said he wanted me to run it. But I thought, oh, well, the guy who was running it, you know, so I just sort of assumed. And he said, well, gosh, let me give this a little thought, Coco, hang on. But he came back pretty quickly and he said, okay, we all talked about it and we're going to give you that chance, right? And so what I didn't do right then and there was ask for the guy's salary, the guy who had, you know, flamed out. I didn't say, you know, I'm sure you paid him an outrageous salary. Instead, I thought, okay, I got the break of a lifetime. I'm going to go kick butt and prove myself. And I failed. I remember my first offsite. I cried my eyes out on the way back because I was so bad. But I got my act together. And in 6 months, I came back to the CEO and I said, am I doing as good a job as you expected that other guy to do? And he said, absolutely. And I said, great, then pay me what you were paying him.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love that. Well, and it's good because you proved yourself first.
Exactly. Yeah. And I kind of
You came in with the metrics even, I'm sure.
Right. And so I sort of kept things in check, right? My point is that I've always sort of been myself, been, you know, super assertive and aggressive, but also vulnerable and, you know, at times completely imposter syndrome and all of this stuff. And I think, you know, trying to keep things in check a little bit so that you don't get frustrated with the way that the world is unfair for women, but you also don't lose opportunity to move the world forward, right? And I think that's sometimes the balance that women have a hard time with, right? Because we're so aware that we might be seen as bitchy or not assertive or whatever it is we're going to be labeled, that we end up sort of in a self-fulfilling prophecy as opposed to just plugging along anyway, being who we are, but taking opportunities as they come.
Well, it's interesting, and we have people who are constantly trying to throw us off our game. By the way, I was made a VP about that age also, and my entire staff was younger than me, and I think some of them had applied for the job. I didn't. I was recruited from outside. And I can't remember how it came up to me, but I was running a division of a big financial services company, and shortly after I got there, they decided to divest. It was an REIT, Real Estate Investment Trust division, and shortly after I got there, they decided to divest of all the properties, and I was VP of Marketing and Investor Relations, so I had to divest of all these properties without, I mean, the goal, of course, was no lawsuits and no negative press, and I did it, which was amazing. What was really funny about the story was I need sleep, and I was not getting a lot of sleep because it was like 24/7, right? And you're in a bubble. You're a publicly traded company. It's a top company. You would know the name. And after about 5 days of this, my staff came into my office and performed what I affectionately refer to as an intervention and said, we've decided you're going home and getting some sleep. which was one of those vulnerable moments, right? And I was like, thank you. I love you. Goodbye. I'll, you know, see you tomorrow, you know, kind of thing. But it's true. You have to just be who you are, right? When I was recruited by Chrysler to head up the communications and co-head the sales and marketing, I was a Martian from outer space. I'd never worked in the car business. I'd never been in electricity. I didn't live in that part of the country. But my boss introduced me from my difference and that he was supporting me. And that helped. And I also did some things. So you can build that bridge, right? You can take strategies to build it. So you kind of answered this, but how do you see women getting in their own way? Is it that they're too aggressive? Is it that they don't seize opportunity, or that they don't seize opportunities enough? Or is it that they allow those moments of imposter syndrome you talked about, or the world, you know, being creepy back to you? How do you think women get in their own way on this trajectory?
I mean, I think there's a variety of ways in which we can let the world get in our way or get in our own ways. Some of it, I will say, is not trusting ourselves enough and keeping at it. You know, kind of like if you're going to be an entrepreneur and look for venture funding, you're going to have hundreds of no's before you get a yes. And as a woman, that may be the case too. You know, so I see this a lot with board seats. It's like, why don't I have a board seat yet? And even for the most logical people, it can take 2 to 3 years for a number of reasons. One is boards meet on a quarterly basis. It's not an urgent position. A lot of board seats, particularly private companies, just go unfilled because there's not the same kind of motivation. And even if you're identified, it can take it. Like, there's all these reasons that have nothing to do with you, but women will internalize it as something to do with them. And it's the same thing with entrepreneurs. Just because somebody doesn't love your baby doesn't mean that the baby's not beautiful, right? Just means you didn't hit the right investor yet. And so just keep going. And I think it's a bit of that, right? Like, just take a lot of no's. It's going to be okay. You're going to get a yes. Just stay with it, right? And I think that's a piece of it. And sort of underestimating our value. We hear this a lot, that we think we have to be better than we really have to be. And some of that comes from the lack of a bell curve, right? Like, if you're a guy, you can look to any number of companies and say, that guy who's running that company is a buffoon. And if he can be there, then so can I, right? But we don't have our bell curve of female buffoons. You know, we have like the one Theranos woman and everybody's terrified of being her. But, you know, but so we look and we are like, oh, well, then there's Diane Greene and there's, you know, Sheryl Sandberg. And you can have your issues with some of her stuff. But on the whole, women think that they have to be amazing in order to land something. And that's just not true.
Or that they need to know Larry Summers kind of quality of person, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, just forget the role models we have are not enough role models to give you yourself. And so you just have to keep trusting in yourself and believing that you should be there. And that the no just means they don't see you, but somebody will see you. And then on the other side of that, I see women getting in their own way sometimes by just feeling a little like frustrated with the situation and kind of like, here I am, they should come find me. And I think that doesn't do you any service either, right? Because they're just not going to. People are going to overlook you. So yes, you do have to do the work and not get frustrated by the fact that you have to do the work.
Well, and I think two things to sort of jump off of that briefly. One is, look at the J.K. Rowling model, right? She was rejected by, I think, like 20 publishers, like every publishing house on earth practically, until she got a little deal with Scholastic or had an agent who said, okay, yeah, I'll take it, you know. Can you imagine being the person now at Norton or Random House or whatever that turned down Harry Potter? I mean, good Lord, right? The other is, I think that we underestimate, you talked about they'll come find me, and we talk about knowing people. You can find people that you need to know, especially today with social media. I do it every day, right? If I read a story about somebody who I want to meet, I want to interview, I figure out a way to get to them. It's really simple. I mean, you just follow the breadcrumbs, right? You can do it through social media. You can go to their company website. I mean, the worst that happens is they respond and say, no, thank you.
Right.
Most of the time, if you ask a question, they'll answer you on some level.
Yeah.
And you've at least made that connection.
Well, and we say to kids coming out of college, you know, line up informational interviews. Informational interviews are really relatively easy to get, right? Somebody says, would you just talk to my kid to do da 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 and help them understand? We can do that for each other as friends too. Like, would you just have a conversation with my friend over here who's interested in joining a board that's similar to the board that you're on? And the next thing you know, you're in that community. But that's the part I mean about deal making. Women not really, you know, playing that deal making game. And deal making is like the, hey, I have something for you. You have something for me. I just want to kind of pick your brain about something. And you're navigating your way from 6 degrees of separation to a goal to one through finding people that represent what you're looking for and going out and saying, I want to talk to you.
And it's understanding that it is a give and take and it's going to be a process. I do this with my coaching clients now. You know, part of the deal of working with me is that you get to leverage my network. You know, if when appropriate, and you have to sort of, you know, get there, right? But I have. And what's interesting to me is the people in some of my clients have kind of, they've been nervous about taking advantage of some of the interviews. And it's kind of, on one hand, it's sweet. On the other hand, it's like, why? You know, here. You know, you're being given this opportunity. And it's exactly what you're saying. I suggest an informational interview. So you focus a lot on getting people on corporate boards. I want to talk about that, but I have one quick question off of something you wrote on your website that really intrigued me and, of course, fits in with our mission here. And that is, you wrote about conscious capitalism and how society is turning to the private sector more and more. And of course, the Larry Flint letter, he's the CEO of BlackRock and the largest investment firm in the world, actually. And that's kind of the paradigm shift that I wrote about in Forbes too, if I'm reading you right. So talk about that shift and how it shows up in the C-suite and the boards.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, one thing is the world is now super connected, right? I mean, I can be out in a rice paddy and I have internet connection and I can get on social media and say something. And the most disconnected of the past is connected. And with that, everybody has a voice. Some voices are heard more so than other voices. But if your voice is striking a chord, you become a social influencer really quickly. It doesn't matter your social standing or your economic standing, right? The whole world. And what that means is that where it was once that business told us what to buy and what to think, you know, your father in the advertising world, right? They created the story for us, right? That the companies told us what was truth. But now that is completely turned around, and the buyer and the consumer and the stakeholder are telling companies what is truth. They're telling companies how to behave, what to make, what we will buy, what we will accept in your supply chain and your behaviors, et cetera. And that is why conscious capitalism is rising. It's not because all of a sudden Larry Fink and everybody got like, you know, sort of became more socialist. It's because, and not as opposed to capitalist, it's because they realize that sustainability of business on many different levels means being able to connect with society as a whole. And society as a whole is in charge, no longer the company.
And that you need the way your business is run to align with our values.
Exactly. And so what's happening in the C-suite then is you're seeing the rise and the equalization of roles that used to be subpar to a core set of roles. You know, the core set of roles was the guy who ran finance, the guy who ran the company, the guy who ran engineering, let's say. But now the rise of the feminine archetype and the need to have a relationship with society as a whole differently has the rise of the chief customer officer, the rise of the CMO. Maybe 7-8 years ago, the CMO started having a really big budget, right? Marketing officer. The rise of the CHRO, that function, the people function, would report to the CFO, you know, as kind of a cost center and a must-have. But it's now with culture and multi-generational workforces and global workforces and gig economy and retooling. I mean, it's become such an important role. And is now reporting more and more to the CEO directly. And so, you know, just even those three roles, you see 35% of chief customer officers are women, 32% of chief marketing officers are women, 55% of CHROs, chief human resources officers, are women. And those have embedded in them the female archetype, which is why you're seeing more women in those roles. Not to say that there should not be and aren't more women rising into the technical roles too, because that is happening. 19% of chief information officers are women. Like, we are starting to see that change. But what I'm saying is the C-suite used to be like 7 people. It's now much bigger. And the boardroom is also becoming more diverse in terms of its skill sets as a result too.
You know, it's interesting. When I was at Chrysler, I sat on the executive committee, and these guys would come in from purchasing or ops or whatever and talk about some new great widget or new system they got. And I would sit there and I'd say, okay, so let me tell you how that's going to play. Let me tell you how that's going to trickle down through the sales chain and, you know, what we might lose as a result of it, right, the decision. And or the press, you know, what the here's the headline, you know, yada, yada, yada. And sometimes they would, my boss stood by me, but some of these guys would look at me and go, whose side are you on? And I go, hey, my job is to keep your butt out of the sling. And this way we can prepare if we need to, and we can make an intelligent decision. So to your point, I'm helping them look at the whole overarching business context of one or two decisions that they think are not a big deal or are just going to lower their cost, inventory, or whatever, right? And I'm like, hello, you know, this is going to ripple, you know, and it made a big difference. I mean, it was actually in that particular case, we ended up not doing what he suggested for that very reason, because the impact would have been too negative, too derogatory.
You know, to that point, every man that I have spoken to, and I've spoken to lots of them, who was on an all-male board and now is part of a diverse gender board, says that the diversity of the gender has made a huge difference in the way they holistically look at problems. And I think that's kind of what you're speaking to, too. I mean, both your role as well as your disposition, right? Like, sort of the way you look at problems and I think that is, as we see more and more gender diverse boards, we will see more and more people understand that intuitively and experientially, and it won't be sort of this logic argument that is hard to wrap our heads around. And same thing with ethnic diversity and sexual orientation and things like that. It's just a matter of we think differently and we look at the world differently and we bring different perspectives and we represent society in different ways. And those are important.
Well, in different experiences. I mean, in that case, part of it was I had been already, I mean, I've gone back and forth in my career between the corporate communications, marketing, advertising side and journalism. So I brought my national journalism experience into the room and said, okay, so if I'm the reporter, this is what I'm going to write, or this is the story I'm going to try to do at 60 Minutes or whatever. And then on the other side, you know, I could look at the sales funnel and say, this is how it's going to play out because these are the criteria that these organizations need to buy these cars, right? So it is interesting. I interviewed Laura Liswood, who you've probably heard of, and she talked about two things related to this. One is that women are more prepared because of this, whether it's imposter syndrome or just wanting to do a better job or whatever. And that's ended up raising the performance of the board because then the men prepare. But it's like the woman comes in super prepared, and the guys go, uh-oh, I guess I better up my game here to keep up. And so the discussion gets more rich.
Yeah, that's absolutely true too. I think it's, there was a design of the boardroom that is no longer relevant in today's world. Businesses are changing so quickly. Entire business models are popping up that are brand new. Every company is a technology company. And so all of these different changes means that the board has to be much more on top of things than they ever were. You know, really were in the past.
And faster, yeah.
Faster, yeah. And the idea that the boardroom is a place you retire to spend your golden years and shed your wisdom of 20, 30, 40 years of work is actually a misnomer for today's society. So two things are happening. One is women are coming in preparing more because we feel like we have to. But two, we're coming in to... we're being asked to come in to change the dynamic. And that's one of the things that I see men rising to and going, wow, we're such a better board. They're not like, ugh, these women came along and now we have to do all this work. It's like, you know, the women are coming in with the innovative perspective. We're being brought in with the go-to-market strategy or the cybersecurity strategy or the technology strategy or the human. We're being brought in with different dynamic roles. And then we're being asked to help guide the discussion in a more forward-looking way, which is what the boards have to do anyway. And so in that sense, the nature of the fact that we're the way we're brought in means that we're naturally going to help boards evolve.
Well, that's interesting because I'm a change agent myself, so I've been brought into positions for that reason. I mean, that's what marketing is, right? Knew this, knew that, right? And I was going to ask you about this because you talked about on your website too, I'm an innovation freak myself. And that is, first of all, I think women are natural innovators because we have had to find another way. We didn't have the reins of power. We didn't have control of the budget. We didn't have the authority to just tell, you know, people what to do back in the day of command and control even. And we didn't have the staff even necessarily, right? The resources. And so we had to find a more creative way, which is naturally innovative. Laura Liswood calls it the dominant versus the non-dominant role, that with women in the non-dominant role, you have to find a different way around it. You can't just go, shh, you have to go, you know, like in a zigzag, a Mervius strip kind of way, right? So become natural innovators. I love that. So one quick question, more question, and then I'm going to ask you just for some career advice. But what are three things you should ask yourself in preparing to be on a board, maybe to determine if you're ready to be on a board? If you want to tie it into how they need to sort of think about, you mentioned how you present yourself. So if you want to tie that in, you can. But what are some like three things that people need to think about to say, well, all these people are getting on boards. Is that something I am qualified for or should think about?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first thing is I think I hear a lot of women say, I'm a great executive. I've accomplished a lot. Boards should want me. I should be on a board. And I think you should step back from that sort of, yes, you're great, to let's imagine that this realm of the boardroom is like outer space, because it is a totally different atmosphere, right? What you do in this room is very different than all the work you do up until that point. And yes, it draws on all your experience, just like if you were an astronaut going to outer space. You know, you're a biologist and you want to go test how plants grow in outer space and blah, blah, blah. And that's great. Yes, you're going to bring your skill there. But do you know how to eat with your suit on? Have you experienced zero gravity? Do you know that you'll be able to manipulate those plants in that atmosphere? So the first thing I would say is kind of build that frame in your mind and then go, okay, it's a totally different atmosphere. So how do I get exposure to that atmosphere so that I know I'm going to thrive and survive and bring my best work there? And if you've never engaged with the board, then it's not the right time to say that you should be on a board yet, right? Like, I think you have to, are you presenting to your own board? Are you in that boardroom on a frequent basis? Are you engaged in environments and programs that help you understand the boardroom? Sometimes it can be a boot camp. Certainly, Athena, what we do on an ongoing basis is we provide weekly, like 3 times a week, training on what goes on in the boardroom and deep dives into everything from D&O insurance to earnings call preparations to how the cap table works in private companies. Like, you really want to know this space before you walk into this space. So if you don't know the space yet, get to know it. Ask to be invited to your own board, to present to your board, or to be a fly on the wall for the more open session. Get the opportunity to be present there. And that's something I don't think we ask for, but if you're a senior executive, you can, you know, I mean, it can't hurt to ask. And then certainly try the simulation with different groups like Athena, NACD, you know, the boot camps. So that aside, the other thing I would say is, in terms of preparation, you have to understand that it's sort of like a kid going to college. There are your matches, your safeties, and your reaches, right? So, you know, and match, safety, and reach in the college setting, like that is kind of level set for you based on your GPA scores, how many AP classes you took, how you scored in your AP exams, you know, what your SAT scores were, right? That kind of sets your safety, match, and reach. And then there's these kind of environmental things too, like I hate the sun, or I really want to be, you know, in Alaska for school. So for boards, it's similar, but the criteria that is kind of your equivalent to your SAT and GPA is scale. How much scale have you led and seen and been a part of? If you've only ever been in small companies, then your matches and your safeties are probably smaller companies. They're the ones that are sort of what you've seen before. Not to say that you can't join a mega company, right? Like, there are the Clara Shees of the world who join the board of Starbucks. But be realistic with yourself. That's a reach, right? And really kind of map the landscape for yourself. And then for your matches and your safeties, discover your way there and use those environments at least for your informational interviews and to talk to people who are board members and to get a sense of what it's like to be in those boards. And don't be afraid to use stepping stones to start in smaller boards and then graduate to your larger boards. It's, you know, it's not a zero sum game, right? It's not like I'm ready, so the world should find me. It's a process.
Well, and it goes back to what we talked about earlier, which is, especially in today's world, you can network your way there eventually. You can use social media. You can say, who do you know? You know, I'd like to get on whatever, the Target board, whatever. Do we know anybody? You know, who do we know? Who knows somebody? I mean, you can look up their SEC filings and see who's on the board. And then you can reach out to them through social media or whatever. I mean, there's different ways to do it. That's great. That's really good advice. So in closing, we like to give people career advice. So we focus on mid-career women, especially in STEM careers, but not exclusively. What would you say to a woman who is mid-career, say 15 years of experience, wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference? She wants to get ahead. She wants to make a lot of money and make a difference. So you've had such a great career and you guide people now on a lot of these transitions. What advice would you have for her?
I mean, one thing I would say is to trust yourself and to realize that if you got this far, you can get much further. And I think I've seen for myself that I've stayed too long, you know, that it was time to leave sooner than I left, that I, you know, I had this nagging feeling that things weren't what they should be for me or around me. And I have had my own moments where I was nervous enough that I didn't, you know, take that other leap. And I think trust yourself, take that other leap, especially now, because for women of color, the world is really listening to us, at least in the US. I know there's parts of the world where that's not true. But I would say that you can succeed. And I think it's hard for women because, you know, particularly let's say if you're first generation American or you're first generation college graduate or you're the first woman in your family to whatever, you have a lot on your shoulders and it's really hard to trust that you're going to be okay and that you're not just lucky, that you really do deserve. And so I would say just trust yourself, take big chances, take risks, know that you'll be fine. And every risk you take is going to have a great reward on the other side.
Oh, I love that. And my going to Chrysler was one of those examples, frankly. I mean, I was offered it from Mars with no automotive experience whatsoever. And I didn't even live there. I was living here and they moved me, brace yourself, to Fargo, North Dakota. So you want to talk about taking a risk. A New York City girl, like my stilettos, did not get a lot of exercise in Fargo, North Dakota, I'll tell you that much. Going into the electric car division, you know, electric car business. But my boss was great. He said, this is exactly why you were successful, because you didn't come in with the baggage, right? So I think the other side to what you're saying is, if somebody offers you an opportunity, they think you can do it. Trust them.
Yes, that's a great.
And don't question them. I mean, you know, are you kidding is not part of your vocabulary, right? And ask for the overseas assignment. Like I had, I interviewed Patsy Doerr when she was head of CSR at Thomson Reuters, and she told me the story of she was at another firm, and she had two little kids at the time. And as she was walking out of a meeting with her boss, she turned around, she said, oh, by the way, don't exclude me from overseas assignments because I have two small kids, because I'm interested. And she, like, bye, have a great day, and walked out. Let it sit there. 2 weeks later, he offered her a job in Hong Kong. So, you know, you have to also put it out there, right? But if somebody offers you something, you may think it's insane, but they believe in you. They wouldn't be offering it to you. They're not offering it to you out of charity. They're offering it to you because they believe you can do it. And I say that to people who work for me, and they go, but I've never done that before. I go, I know, you can figure it out. I believe you can figure it out.
Yes. And also, I think I like that. Have the grace to assume also that people's intentions are good. You know, that if they don't offer you the overseas position, maybe they are thinking, well, she has two little kids and she's not going to want. So putting it out there and going, hey, just by the way, I can take my two little kids with me and just assume good intention. But yeah, if you want it, put it out there for sure.
Yeah, it's a great experience for kids too, right? So any final thoughts? You've been fabulous. I adore you and it's really great. Any final thoughts before we call it a day?
You've covered so much ground. It was fantastic. I really appreciate that you do these and that you had me on. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Coco Brown, founder and CEO of Athena Alliance. Sounds like a Hollywood actress, Coco Brown. I love your name. So are you changing how you lead in today's crazy crises? How is your company affected by the pandemic? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and ask to join our private Facebook group while you're there. And you can leave it on Apple Podcasts with your review and subscribe to our mailing list to stay abreast of our great interviews with people like Coco, our blogs, and career advice. And again, if you want more career advice, please reach out to me on Twitter because you are not alone. We can help you. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time, and please stay safe.